are. In the beginning of Perek Yitzayin, chapter 17, I have set the lofty goal of completing chapter 17 today. It's somewhat less lofty when you look at and realize that there are only 14 psukim, so it's not like, oh no, how's he going to do that? We're on page 981 in the Art Scroll Tanakh, and we started to discuss this already last time. Chapters 17 and 18 are the fourth unit in the prophecies against the various enemies of the Jewish people. The first one, of course, was Babel, Babylon. Then we had the Plishtim, the Philistines. Then we had Moab, spent a while on them. And now the Syro-Ephraimite alliance of Aram and Yisrael. And we group them together. Even though Yisrael are Jews, and Aram are decidedly not, nonetheless, we are going to group them together. And the reason for it is fairly obvious. Right? Why are we grouping them together? Because their sin, the primary sin for which Israel is being punished, is the alliance that they made with Aram, Aram, Syria, Damascus, whatever term you want to throw on it. Indeed, Rashi is frustrated, and I brought it for you in source number one. He's frustrated by something that we haven't yet seen, but jump into the text first before we look at the Rashi. That's in general a good idea. But looking at page 981, right? So chapter 17 is what you want. Okay. Chapter 17, sentence 2. We're going to come back to sentence 1. Don't think we're skipping that. But in sentence 2, we talk about cities that are going to be destroyed. Azuvot Are Aro Air. And we're going to talk about the sounds in a minute, or a few minutes. We'll get there. But Azuvot means abandoned. Are Aro Air, the cities of Aro Air. The cities of Aro Air are abandoned. And again, this is part of the description of the destruction that's going to befall this northern alliance. But Rashi is bothered. And it's really a medrash that he's quoting that is troubled. Because Aro Air is one of our cities. You're talking about the destruction of Aram, Damascus, and you're mentioning Aroer. We know where Aroer was. Aroer was one of the cities the Jews conquered east of the Jordan. It's mentioned in Sefer Bamidbar. It's mentioned multiple times, actually, in Sefer Bamidbar. Reuven and Gad, when they come to Moshe and say, look at all this land east of the Yarden. Isn't this land great? It's perfect for grazing our animals. One of the cities they mention is Aroer. It's not Aramean. Doesn't make any sense. What is it doing here? So Rashi quotes you a medrash that seeks to answer it, and Rashi, in a rare move, says, I don't like what we're seeing in this medrash. He says, number one, Midrash Agada Matmia. A medrash is shocked. Really, matmia doesn't mean shocked. Matmia could mean it creates shock. In other words, it's a shocking midrash. You could read it that way, because Rashi doesn't like what it's going to say. Yes.
Surprise.
Yeah. But it's more that it generates surprise, as opposed, it is a surprising midrash. Lefisha aro er me'eretz Yisrael aita. But the medrash's question, which is why I think it's saying the medrash is shocked, the medrash's question is, aro er is part of Israel. Shenemar, as the pasuk says, ve'eth aro er. Omein b'damesek u'machriz ba'aro er. You're talking about what's going to happen in Damascus. And you mentioned a city that's not of Damascus. It's not of Aram. Everyone understands the problem, right? Okay? So the medrash that he quotes answers. Ela shehayu b'damesek shvakim kiminyan yemot hachama. The answer is that in Aro Er, they had marketplaces, as many as the days of the solar calendar. V'chol achad yesh ba'akum. And each one had an idol in it. V'ovdim la'yom achad ba'shana. And each one was worshipped one day every year. That's not odd. What Rashi is saying is not, and what the Medrash, it's not really Rashi, what the Medrash is saying is not, look at that, they had so many different idols that they worshipped one each day. The Gemara talks about, in a separate context, the idea of worshipping particular idols on particular days of the year. Each one has its feast day. It's associated with a certain arrangement of the constellations. And so each day there is another idol that is worshipped appropriate to that day of the year. Incidentally, the other piece of it that's fascinating is we have traditions from different points within Jewish history about cities in which people gathered to worship whatever idol out of the conglomerate of idols that were locally worshipped, or in other words, market cities. Actually, in early Islam, they had it in I think it was Medina. They had this idea that it was a city that had multiple idols, and each group went there, and they had days that were for their idol to be worshipped. So what the Medrash is depicting here is that you had an idol for every day of the year, and each day it was worshipped by somebody. V'Yisrael asu et kulan kibbutz echad, except the Jews, overachievers. The Jews gathered all the idols together. V'hayu ovin es kulan v'chol yom. And they said, let's worship all 365 daily. That was what the Jews did. They're looking for something. That's the Medrash. And Makach is Kirma, Polet, Aroer, Eitzel, Damascus. And that's why Aroer is mentioned with Damascus, because what it's saying is that in Damascus they had the idols, in the city, they had the idols of various locations. And the Jews worshipped the idols associated with each one, including apparently all the idols of Aroer. Something along those lines is what the Medrash is saying. But Rashi says that's not what we're talking about here. V'anima farshol lefi pshat hamikra. He says that's not. I'm going to explain it based on the basic text. Al shnis chaber b'tzinu pekach ben Ramaliyahu yachad. And the answer is the northern kingdom allied itself with Aram. And that is what we are talking about here. So we're mentioning Aroer as a city of Yisrael, as a city of the northern kingdom. That's why Aroer is mentioned here. It's because it was a city that belonged to the northern kingdom. Remember, the northern kingdom includes east of the Jordan. It includes Reuven and Gad, as well as half of Manasseh. So the point for us is, and I'll take you one second, the point for us is that Rashi floats the idea from the Medrash that we are punishing the northern kingdom for a sin of idolatry. And Rashi says that's not really what's going on here. It's not about Avodah Zarah. They could have been guilty of Avodah Zarah. That's their track record. But the reason why they're here, and the reason why they're mentioned along with the northern kingdom, with Syria, is because of the political alliance. That's what this section is punishment for.
I don't know why, but I seem to recall that there are a number of cities, and one is Arlar, that appear in various places in that part of the world.
So we're coming to that.
Okay.
Yeah, well, we will get there. You are correct. But that's one idea here. Janine?
I think the Medrash doesn't seem to be so far away from what we read, because later on it says, you left God who saved you. So if there is a rebuke for Israel to worship other gods.
I suppose. I mean, the question is going to be how you translate leaving God. Is it leaving God for idolatry, or is it leaving God to seek allies? Exactly, and you went looking for alliance. Again, you could read the entire section as about idolatry, or you could read the entire section as about seeking the forbidden political alliance. You can go both ways with this. Yes. But I think, again, knowing the history of the two nations that are here, it does seem fairly clear, as Rashi is saying, that it is political. Malbim adds a twist, though. Take a look at source number two. Omer, it says, Re'ei ha'evdel bein Damesek u'bein Ephraim. See the difference between Damascus and Ephraim, Ephraim being the northern kingdom. Damesek asher nechrava husar legamri milehechashev od bein cheshbon ha'arim. Damascus, which is destroyed entirely, is removed from being counted among cities, meaning it's gone. Rak yachshavu me'ata bein cheshbon shel iyim anasim aydem apolet shel batim. They're now listed among the ruins. That's what happens to Damascus, as described in the section. of Alarei Aroer me Ephraim. But the cities of Aroer of Ephraim, Ha'azuvot Nechbar, which are already abandoned because the ones east of the Jordan are actually destroyed first. Einam Shmamot Kolkach, they're not as desolate. They're just described here in the text as being four flocks to graze. He's looking at Pasuk Bet, which says, Azuvot Aroer La Adarim Tihyena. They're going to be four grazing. But there's life there. The Velola Bad Shirusham Lifrakim, not occasionally. Rav Rabzu Bikviyut Bein Macharid. But the text says that they're there persistently. They're there on an ongoing basis. They're unafraid. Because you don't have wild beasts, because you don't have houses falling. In other words, what Malbim is doing is what Malbim always does, which is he looks so closely at the language in the text. And what he sees here is that in Pasuk Aleph, in sentence 1, Damesek is described as Mi'i Mapala, a ruin of collapse. Everything collapses. Everything is gone. That's Damesek. On the other hand, Are Aroer La Adarim Tihyena, the cities of Aroer, they'll be for grazing. Rab Zuva in Macharid, the flocks will graze there, and no one will be afraid. So, as far as Malbim is concerned, it's true that the sin is the alliance, but they will not suffer the same fate as their ally. That's the idea. The difference between the two approaches, the difference between the approach that we take of saying they're going to be destroyed for creating this alliance, or the approach of Malbim, yeah, but they're going to survive, I think it's a substantive difference in terms of how Yeshaya, expressing prophecy, views the northern kingdom. Right? Are they still family? Right, remember we talked about this regarding Moab and the debate. Is Yeshaya crying for Moab? Well, if Yeshaya is crying for Moab, I would hope he would be crying for the northern kingdom also. I would hope we'd get some mercy there as well.
He seems to be saying that.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm seeing in Malbim's read, as opposed to the read that says, nope, they're just gone. Which is, I think, the more straight read before you get to Malbim. Okay. So, the structure of the unit here is relatively straightforward. We're going to start with a general introduction to the punishment of Syria and Ephraim, the first three sentences in chapter 17. Then it moves into the punishment of Ephraim, expressed in agricultural imagery, and that's the body of the chapter, sentences 4 to 11. And then the last few sentences will be the punishment of Assyria, who had attacked the northern kingdom. God is going to zap Assyria for it. And then chapter 18 is going to be way out. Chapter 18 is way out. It's about news arriving in Ethiopia, potentially about the 10 lost tribes. That's going to be fascinating. Susan?
Here in this one, it explains our rare that it could be from the south, but then it doesn't make sense. And then it says, others render Aroer as ruined cities, and that in that case, the text refers to Syria.
Yeah, I'm getting there.
Oh.
Yeah. The problem fundamentally, now we get to the actual psukim. I just wanted to give that as the intro in terms of, again, why we're grouping them together. Now we have a better perspective on that, as well as sort of the view of the northern kingdom. Is it all destruction? Will they be spared somewhat? And then we saw the outline. Let's look at the psukim themselves. What you have to focus on, at least a little bit, even for a non-Hebrew speaker, you have to focus on it anyway, is the way Yeshaya plays with sounds. We've seen it before, but look at this. I'm going to read in the Hebrew the opening couple of sentences here. Masa damasek, hine damasek, musar meir vaita mei mapala. He's got that mem thing going. Yeah, he has the... Oh, you mean Masa, Damesek, Damesek, Musar. Yeah, you're right. Yeah. And then you have the ayins, which if I could do an ayin properly, gutturally, you know, you'd really get it. Azuvo, are, aro, er. I might need hot water or something. The La Adarim, right? It's the ayin sound over and over and over again. And then in Pasuk Gimel, he goes back to the manners. V'nishbat mivtzar me'afrayim u'mamlacham midamesek u'shar aram. He's got the mems going. I have no idea why he chooses these sounds. I don't know. I mean, the samach, you're right, has a hissing connotation to it. The mem and the ayin, you got me. But it's fascinating the way he plays it.
The S sounds are affiliated with which?
Sorry? Well, you had said it was a hissing sound.
I see it's a hissing sound. Is it domestic? That's, you see, that's affiliated with the enemy, the Damascus.
Yeah.
So that's the hissing sound. Now, what was the mem sound?
It was all over the place. It was Masa, Damasek, Damasek, Musar, Meir, Mei, Mapala, Mivtsar, Mei Ephraim, Mamlacham, Mi Damas. I don't know. If you say so. And the ayin?
It's very hard.
Yeah, I don't know. Mush.
Mem is the most commonly used phonetic all languages, appearing in 95% of languages.
Interesting. What would you do with that here?
I have no idea. From Mother's Day, Ima is a mem word, as is Rechem and Racham.
Got it. Okay.
And the English words are also mem words.
Mama is one of the first sounds.
Right. It's true. Okay. Yes.
In the lighter vein, it maybe at that time it was a popular rap.
That would be it. Right, the Mennonite.
Because the rap didn't just start recently.
No.
They liked certain sounds.
No, Yeshaya is for sure a pioneer in that regard. So I don't know what to do with a particular choice of sounds here, or whether there is anything to be seen in the choice of sounds. Remember, Yeshaya wants people to listen and remember what he's saying, and this is a very good way to accomplish that goal. This is catchy. The less catchy to non-Hebrew speakers, but to his audience, it would be meaningful. That's number one. Number two, this business of Azugot Arei Aroer, which we already started on. So we saw that Medrash in Esther Rabbah is quoted by Rashi, bothered by the fact that Aroer was a Moabite city that became ours in a war with Amori. It's not Aram, so that Medrash says it's Ephraim's city, and they sinned like Aram. That's the way that he reads it. The straight read is as Rashi says above, right? The Rashi that we said, it's Ephraim's city punished for allying with Aram. Not for Avodah Zarah like Aram, but for an alliance with Aram. And that's another read. But take a look at Abarbanel in source number 3. And this is... Susan, this is where they got that from. He says, after bringing the different explanations, Abarbanel quotes Esther. The Chalzei Inenu Shoveli. He says, all this doesn't do it for me. It's not sufficient. Why? For Aroer, on the eastern side of the Jordan, was one of God's cities. And how could it identify all of the tribes of Reuben and Gad and half of Manasseh by the name Aroer? Why would it make any sense to call the land east of the Jordan the cities of Aroer? Why pick Aroer as the representative? Aside from the fact that it was the smallest of God's cities, which is why it was listed last. When the Torah describes the cities they built up, and last one is Ve'et Aroer. So it doesn't make sense that that's going to be your central one. And if it was one city, he says, why would it say the cities of Aroer? Arei Aroer. He doesn't like that either. Therefore, it would seem more correct to say that Aroer was a big Aramean city. It wasn't one of ours. And this goes back to what Mira was saying as well. It was a big Aramean city, including many sub-cities. It was not the Aroer of Moab, but another. Even Ammon had another city named Aroer. But the name Aroer means destruction. In Hebrew, Ayin Reish, like Er Ve'ona or Ariri, is often used to describe desolation and destruction. So that's what he's suggesting here, is that it's just another city. It's an Aramean city. Radak has it also. the same idea before Abarbanel does, but I like the way Abarbanel wrote it. But that's the idea. It's an Aramean city, so we have multiple explanations for Azuvot Arei Aroer. Bottom line is that in this section, however you read where Aroer is, the northern kingdom and the Arameans are in trouble, and in Pasuk Gimel, in sentence 3, we are told they're going into exile. Their fortresses are gone, they're going into exile, and Rashi notes, if you take a look in Malachim Bet, Kings 2, chapter 16, sentence 9. Kings 2, chapter 16, sentence 9. Just a quick look. Page 921. This is exactly what happened. Vayal Melech Ashur El Damesek Vayispeseha. The king of Assyria attacked Damascus and took it. Vayagleha Kirav Esritzinemis. Exiled her and killed Ritzin, who was the ruler. I bring that. We saw that much earlier in the year when we talked about the idolatry that was found there. But I bring it here only in order to make the point that that this actually does come true, that Aram is indeed exiled. So this is a case where we actually know what destruction was predicted and when it took place. Some of them we don't know. Okay, but now we shift to talk about the punishment of Ephraim. And again, it's in agricultural imagery, which makes sense, because Ephraim is the northern kingdom. They are rural, farm country, or mountains also. But in any case, Psukim Dalet Tavav, sentences 4 to 6, back on page 981. We're going to see ghosts. How do you like that? You'll see. Vahaya
vayamahu. Yeah, Janine. Just the passage before that. What does that mean? Kifot in Israel.
Where are you reading? Oh, back in Malachim?
No.
Here?
Gimel.
Oh, Pasuk Gimel. Sorry. Right, v'nishbad mitzarmei Ephraim, the fortresses of Ephraim will be gone. Umamlocha midamesek usha'aram, and monarchy is going to leave Damascus and the rest of Aram. Kichvod b'nei Yisrael yehu, that what will happen to Aram will be like what happens to the glory of the northern kingdom. Nuhum Hashem, this is the word of
destruction.
Correct. Just like happened to Kichvod b'nei Yisrael, that's what will happen to Aram. That's the idea. It throws you off a little bit because the esnachta is under the word aram. It sounds like you have a pause there, but that's the way that the sentence is read. Okay. So v'haya b'yomahu, it will be on that day. Yidal kivod Yaakov. There's that term again, right? The honor of Yaakov will be weakened. Umishman b'saro yeirazeh, and the fat of his flesh will be made thin. The enemy will be, the Assyrians will be, like one who gathers katsir kama, the standing grain. Uzro'o shibalim yiktzor, with his arm he cuts the sheaves. Vayakim lakeit shibalim be'emek refa'im, he will be like somebody who gathers sheaves in emek refa'im. We're going to come back to that term. Vinisharbo olelot, kinokev zayit, and what will remain will be olelot. Olelot are individual fruit, either individual grapes or individual olives. Kinokev zayit, in this case it's olives, like when one is nokev zayit. Anyone here ever see an olive harvest? No? Okay. So an olive harvest, the way it works is they take sticks and they bang the branches, often having to go up into the tree in order to do it, and the olives rain down, and then they are able to collect them. So that's the term nokev zayit. You find it elsewhere in Tanakh as well, including in Chumash. So he says, all you'll have left will be these random olives, like when you bang the tree to knock down the last one. Shnayim shlosha gargarim barosh amir. Two or three individual berries, individual olives at the head of the top branch. Arba'a chamisha bisi'ifeha. Four or five on her branches. Poriya, where she bears fruit. Ne'um Hashem Elokei Yisrael. This is the word of Hashem, God of Israel. Pause here. There is a two-level vision going on here. On one level, it's poverty, it's hunger, it's scarcity of grain. But there's another level here that the commentators understood, which is it's a parable. What is this supposed to represent?
Those that are left alive?
Those who are left living there. Those who are left living there, meaning they're going to go into exile. So all that will remain is one here, one here, one here, and the rest of them are gone. Malbim, once again, shows us why he is Malbim. Did you notice in sentence 5 into 6, the way that the image changed started out with the kesov katsir kama, like gathering the standing grain, using your arm to cut the sheaves, right? And then it continued to milaket shibalim, gathering the sheaves. And then it continued to random olives on the branches. So look what Malbim does with this. This is why he's Malbim. Take a look at number 4. It illustrates the three exiles which Sancheirev exiled. Meaning Sancheirev comes through multiple times. The first exile was like gathering standing grass, like gathering a field's harvest which stands in its full growth, filled with the blessing of God. It's all over the place. You just have to reach out and you gather it. That's all you have to do. The second time, and he'll harvest sheaves in his arm, appearing only like one who harvests scattered sheaves, not full standing grain. And then the third time, he will be like one who gathers sheaves in Emek Rephaim, a place that is thin, where only a few sheaves grow. One who would try to gather them cannot harvest them with a scythe and sickle, but only gather them one by one. He doesn't get to the olives, actually, here. He sees it even with the verse before that. So it's three different stages in the harvest, so to speak, of the northern kingdom. There are some who assume that it actually doesn't refer to the northern kingdom, it actually refers to Yehuda, because Sancheirev did invade Yehuda as well, before he got stopped at Yerushalayim. And there's even a Gemara in Sanhedrin Tzarihei, which explains this as referring to Sancheirev's forces. After God punishes them, then they will be few. But that's clearly not the straight read. I did bring it for you in number 5. If you take a look at source number 5, I brought you what the Gemara does. The Kamanish Shayer Mehem. How many will remain of Sancheirev's Assyrian army? Rav Amar Asara. Rav says 10 soldiers will remain. Where do you get that from? From the vision given to Achaz back in chapter 10, where he said a youth could record them. So Kamanar Yacholichtov. How much can a youth write? Asara. He can count to 10. He's got 10 fingers. But Shmuel disagrees, and he says, no, Tisha, only 9 will remain. Why? Because the text says, Arba'a chamisha b'si'ifeha, 4 and 5 in the branches. So 4 plus 5 is 9. I can do math. However you read that, the general trend is to assume it's not talking about Sancheirev's army, but rather it's talking about the northern kingdom. But here's one piece that I wanted to make sure to highlight for you. Why did he mention Emek Rephaim? Like gathering sheaves in Emek Rephaim. Why did you mention Emek Rephaim of all places? What's bothering me about mentioning Emek Rephaim?
He wanted a coffee.
Sorry?
He wanted a coffee.
He wanted a coffee. Something else. Where is Emek Rephaim?
German colony.
Yeah. Yerushalayim.
Is that where it was?
Yes. Emek Rephaim was described back in Yehoshua. It was solidly in Yehuda. Not in Yisrael. Like, why did you pick Emek Rephaim for your image? Does it make any sense?
Well,
you mentioned the wrong place. Yeah.
You think?
Well, Abarbanel doesn't think. Abarbanel thinks that this is just fine. He says, if you jump to number 7, I'm going to come back to number 6. Lefishu emek shekhtiro ram u'ad v'razeh. It's a valley where the harvest isn't so good. There's only a little there. It's been just like it's described in the text. It's not a great place for stuff to grow. And Abar Manel doesn't say it, but it'll be familiar to Yeshaya's audience. Right? Yeshaya, if he's going to talk to them about a place where things don't grow well, he's going to pick a place that they are familiar with. That makes sense.
Isn't the Ebrahim also mentioned something to do with the Plishtim?
So we're going to see a little bit more about Emek Rephaim in just a minute. We're going to get there. Radak uses this to support the idea that we're also talking about Sennacherib's invasion of Judea. It's not only about the northern kingdom. Now go back to that Radak in number 6. Sorry about bridging the page there. Zachar Emek Rephaim, it mentioned Emek Rephaim, ki hu samuch liYerushalayim, because it is close to Jerusalem. Umelech Ashur tafas hakol mashalachasher toch liYerushalayim. He took stuff that was in Jerusalem as well. So that's Radak's read. But I think there's something else going on here. How does Emek Rephaim get its name?
Where's the Rephaim in the north?
From the giant
what original. I remember learning about Abraham and people said a math, and I thought Rephaim were the people in the.
So there were Rephaim who were giants. They were very big people. We find them mentioned in Chumash, absolutely. But take a look at the way Yeshaya specifically refers to Rephaim, because he does it multiple times. Go back to chapter 14, sentence 9. This word is not new to us. It's on page 977. Part of his vision against Babylon. Sha'ol mitachad ragzal lecha likrat boecha, he says to the Babylonians. Sha'ol, the grave, the depths. They are agitated, waiting for your arrival. Orer lecha rifa'im. The rifa'im, which I see Art Scroll renders as giants, we're going to have to revisit that, are awakened for you. Kol atudei eretz, all of the leaders of the land. Hekim mikisotam, kol malchei goyim, he took them up from their thrones, all of the kings of the nations. So these are some kind of inhabitant of a netherworld. Now jump to chapter 26, sentence 14, please. I gave you the references in source number 8 on the sheet, so you can see it there. But it's page 997. Here, Yeshaya is describing Yom HaDin, the day of judgment. And in sentence 14, you see it, page 997, he says, Meitim bal yichyu. They are dead, they will not come back to life. Rifa'im bal yakumu. They are Rifa'im, they will not rise. You notice what the Art Scroll did this time? Lifeless, never to arise. They are destroyed and so forth. And one more reference, same chapter, sentence 19. Yechyu meitecha. This is one of the references in Tanakh to Tchiyat HaMeitim, to the dead coming back to life. Yechyu meitecha nevelati yikumun. Hakitzu v'anu shochnei afar kital arot alecha ve'avaret rifa'im tapil. The reference here, you can see it in the English. There they took the lifeless as the translation again for rifa'im. Tal orot talecha, your dew is tal orot, which they render here as dew that revives vegetation. Ve'eretz rifa'im tapil, and you, God, will topple the rifa'im to the ground. Rifa'im is often used to refer to ghosts.
They only refer to it as ghosts,
yeah.
I thought it was shades.
Right. Shades, ghosts, spirits. Exactly. But that suggests to me another image here. Emek Rephaim not as Valley of the Giants, but Valley of the Ghosts. That's what he's trying to describe happening to Yisrael. It's going to be the Valley of the Ghosts. There's no life there. To me, that's a logical read of Yeshaya's choice of a location here to illustrate what's going to happen to the northern kingdoms. I think that's a legitimate read. Okay. I'm just looking at the Dan Mikraks. I thought I had seen in his commentary somewhere. Yes, he mentions that near Emek Rephaim is Gei Ben Hinnom. Gei Ben Hinnom, which is of course the place where Molech was worshipped, and becomes the name for hell in Judaism. That's where the name Gehenim comes from. So I think that supports my read of what's going on here. Okay. So that's the prediction, is that they're going to be leveled by Sanherib, by the Assyrian invasion. And then take a look at sentences 7 and 8. Because somebody will be listening at that point. Bayom Hahu, on that day, Yish'er Ha'adam al Osehu, a person will turn to his Creator. Ve'inav el Kadosh Yisrael Tirena, his eyes will see the Sacred One of Israel, will turn to God. Ve'lo Yish'er el HaMizbechot Ma'aseh Yadav, he's not going to turn to the altars of those he created with his own hands. Doesn't mean the altar is created by your hands. It means the altars of those gods who you created. Va'asher asu etz be'otav lo yireh. He is not going to look upon that which he made with his own fingers. Va'asherim v'hachamanim, the different kinds of idols that were worshipped there. They're going to turn to God. And again, not to the idol. So going back to Janine's point from the beginning, you could read this as a statement that their sin is Avodah Zarah, is idolatry. Or you could read it as their sin was looking for allies, and now they're going to turn to God. Who is it who turns to God here? Who are we describing? So it's hard to say it's Ephraim because they're gone. Right? They don't remain. And you can't, you know,
the remnants from the old tree sort of thing?
Right, so maybe it's the remnants. So Rashi says it's the tzaddikim. The problem I have with that is the tzaddikim didn't build these altars in the first place. They never worshipped idols. That's why they're still there. So Radak says it's the southern kingdom. It's Judea. They're going to learn a lesson from what they see. If you take a look at source number 9, Chizkiyahu hechazir lemutav Yisrael. Chizkiyahu brought Israel back to the good. Ubi'er akum mibeit hamikdash umin haaretz. He got rid of idolatry from the temple, from the land. Ve'evin v'hora osam ki Hashem hu Elokim v'lo ro'oi la'avod v'liftoach bo. And Hashem is God. He is the only one we should serve. He's the only one we should trust. And zeu sha'amar al osehu. And that's why it says they'll turn back to their Creator. She'avinu ki Elokim hu osat ha'adam v'yotzro v'hu kadosh Yisrael shakidesh Yisrael v'ilam min ha'amim li yoslo u'lo'ovdo levado. That God is the one. He'll understand. God is the one who created us. He's the one who sanctified us. He's the one who separated us from the nations. And He is the one we should serve. That's the way that Radak reads it. And that's actually predicted. We already saw this prediction. Go back in Yeshaya to chapter 8, sentence 21 on page 969. We saw this. V'haya ki yirav v'hitkatzaf. When he is hungry, when he is angry, v'kileel b'malko v'elohav, he will curse his king, he will curse his gods, ufana l'mala, and he will turn to heaven. Some debate when we did chapter 8 about who it's referring to, but taking it in this context, it's referring to the northern kingdom. Okay. So what we've seen so far is the desolation of Syria, the desolation of the northern kingdom, and the statement that it will be a ghost land. It will be like Emek Rephaim. You will stop looking for allies or idols, and instead you will look to your Creator. And then we get a fascinating section. This is my favorite part of the parak. Sentences 9 to 11. Psukim Tet to Yid Aleph. We are back on page 983.
983?
983. Sentences Tet to Yid Aleph. Bayom Hahu, on that day, Yehu arei ma'uzo ka'azuvat ha'choresh v'ha'amir asher azvu mipnei b'nei Yisrael. On that day, the cities that had been his strongholds will be like azuvat ha'choresh v'ha'amir, that which remains, that which is abandoned from the choresh. Choresh is a forest. The amir, the branches of the trees. Asher azvu mipnei b'nei Yisrael, which they left before the children of Israel. Vaitashimama, it will be in ruins. Ki shachachat elokei yish'eich, because you forgot the God who saved you. Vitzur ma'uzech lo zachart, you did not remember the tzur, the rock literally, that was your source of strength. Alkein tit'i nit'e na'amanim uzmorat zar tizra'enu. There are different ways to translate this line here, the end of sentence 10. Rashi's way of reading it is, you will plant good plants, as I planted, like na'amanim, like na'im. You will plant pleasant plants, like I, God, did. However, what's going to emerge is a vine that is foreign. Zmorat zar, you're not going to get that which you planted. Biyom nit'ech tesagsegi. On the day that you plant, it's going to produce wonderful, wonderful growth. Tesagsegi is to grow very quickly. Uvaboker zareich tafrichi. In the morning, your seeds will flower forth. Neid katsir biyom nachala uch'ev anush. So that is a very hard piece to translate. This neid katsir biyom nachala uch'ev anush. The art scroll renders it as, but your branch is removed on a day of affliction and acute pain. We're going to come back to that. But this section, these three sentences, are fascinating. What's going on here is fascinating. Tell me something. When you read these sentences, and specifically when you look at sentence 9, the fortress will be like that which is abandoned in the forest, which they abandoned before the children of Israel. Who are they who abandoned it before the children of Israel? What are you talking about? Canaanim? Sorry? Right, the inhabitants we conquered, the Canaanim. So that's the tendency, is to read it that way. The land will be abandoned now, like it was abandoned by the Canaanim when you enter the land. And the way to read that then is, because you forgot the God who saved you before the Canaanim, therefore you plant nit'ei na'amanim, you plant pleasant plants, like I did. Like Hashem did. I planted you in the land in front of the Canaanim, or to replace the Canaanim. I put you there. This is something that you see in Hosea. Hosea has this image of the Jews as a plant that were put there and that did not grow in a loyal way. Instead, you grew differently. You didn't grow the way that you were supposed to grow. So too, that's what's going to happen to you, and the result is going to be that you will have a bad harvest. But I think there's something deeper here in this message, which is a Tanakh-wide message, which is about reversion to Canaan. Take a look, please, at the reference I gave you in number 10. Kings 1, Malachim Aleph, chapter 16. You'll see what I mean. It is page 853. Goes back to the time of Ahav. Ahav, who of course was Eliyahu's nemesis. Look at the description here of the deeds of King Ahav. Sentences 29 to 34. So we're told, I'm going to do a loose translation of the Hebrew, you could follow on either side. Ahab, son of Omri, reigned over Israel in the 38th year of Asa, the king in the southern kingdom. Ahab is in the north. And Ahab ben Omri reigns over Israel in Samaria for 22 years. And Ahab ben Omri does what is bad in the eyes of God, more so than anybody who preceded him, which is saying something. It was very easy for him, very light in his eyes, to follow the sins of Yeravam ben Nevat. He marries Izebel, daughter of the king of Sidon, and he goes to worship the Baal and to bow to it. He sets up an altar for the Baal in the Shomron, and Ahav creates the Asherah as well. He worships the Asherah gods too. And Ahav does more to anger God, more so than all of the kings of Israel who preceded him. And in his day, the El of Beit El built up Yericho. And if you remember the curse that Yoshua gave, Yoshua said, anybody who builds Yericho in the beginning will lose his oldest, and as these continue, he'll lose the rest of the kids. And sure enough, he established the city with Aviram, his firstborn, and with Seguv, his youngest, he established its doors, as Hashem spoke via Yoshua bin Nun. Tell me something. What's odd in the psukim that we just read? What doesn't fit?
The story about
Chia. Yeah, the story about Chia. What is that story doing there? First of all, you're telling me Ahav builds all sorts of idolatry and is worse than any other king. And by the way, they built up Yericho. On the list of Averot, of Ahav, where does Yericho fit? He married the daughter of the king of Sidon. And by the way, they also built up Yericho. It just, I don't understand the level here that you're doing. That's number one. Number two, whose sin is that? Whose sin is it? It's Chiel's sin, not Achav's sin. Why are you blaming Achav for that? In his day, Chiel built up Yericho. What? Who cares? This is Achav we're talking about. So what's the answer?
That's the status of the people of the land. That's what Achav brought them.
That's what Achav generated? Could be. I think you could say something stronger. Why did Yoshua say not to rebuild it? What was the reason why? We don't have that with any other conquest. Not in Yoshua's day. Today in a casino.
They were told that have one temple only in Jerusalem and they have one in Jericho.
Really? Not in Yoshua's time. That's not. No. Yoshua's first conquest is Yericho. That is the beginning of restoring to the land the identity of the land of Hashem, the land of the Avot, the land that had been promised to them, getting rid of all that is Canaan. And Yahushua says, no one is allowed to take from the spoils. No one is allowed to benefit from this city. Right? There's a lot of debate. Did he decide that on his own? Was that what Hashem told him to do? But Yahushua declares, this place shall be left desolate and nobody should build this again. I don't want this to become Canaan again. Building up Yericho is reversion to the identity of Canaan. That's Yahushua's message. Fast forward to the time of Ahav. Ahav restores the idols of Baal and Asherah. Right? This is the king worshipping Canaanite gods. He marries the daughter of Sidon up in the north. And he creates this reversion of the community such that Chiel says, well, I'm rebuilding Yericho. I'm going to rebuild Jericho. We are Canaan again. It's that reaction I have whenever I go to go buy wine and they have Canaan wine. It really bothers me. Not as much as Noah wine. That bothers me more. But Canaan wine, it's the opposite of what we're trying to say. Don't do that. But that's the image, I think, that Yeshaya is borrowing here. I think it's what Yeshaya is doing. Look at the Psukim now. He says again in Pasuk Tet in sentence 9, his cities, right, the cities that the Canaanim abandoned before the Jewish people are now going to be desolate. The ones that you got from Canaan, the ones that you took, are now going to be rolled back to their desolate state. And then in sentence 10, because that which I planted in the land went astray, therefore whatever you plant is going to go astray. And then in sentence 11, it's an interesting play on words. Did you notice the last words in sentence 11 in the Hebrew? Neid katsir biyom nachala uke'ev anush. The word nachala is generally understood here not to mean portion, but rather to refer to a river sweeping things away, or to refer to chole, illness. But he chooses the word nachala specifically. Why? Because nachala also refers to your portion. That was what the land was supposed to be for us. It's a pun on nachala. It's part of the message. Israel was supposed to be nachala for you, and I'm going to use that term nachala to refer to your destruction. That's what I think Yeshaya is doing in this section. Yes, Susan.
I'm just wondering why 9 seems to be the only verse that is not in poetry. And all the way is written here in my book anyways. And the rest is written in poetry. Like, why did he veer from his style?
I see the whole thing as poetry.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I don't know why they did it as they did it. It's a longer sentence, but... Yeah, I wouldn't necessarily buy into that. And more, take a look at number 12 on your sheet. That's actually a perfect segue. This doesn't have to do with the substance of the text, but it's Ibn Ezra giving a tip to the reader. And I feel like if Ibn Ezra is going to go to the trouble of giving us a tip about how to read Tanakh, we should read it. He says on sentence 11, sentence 11 is such trouble trying to figure out what in the world it's talking about in the second half of the sentence. Neid katsir biyom nachala. So look what he says. He says, "V'hineh amar lacha klal b'divrei nevi'ei atochachot." He says, "I'm going to give you a principle for understanding what the prophets of rebuke say." Ki mechetzi apasuk nilmod al chetzio b'rov. As a general rule, if you don't know what you're doing in the sentence, you can use one half of the sentence to interpret the other. Because, as we've seen multiple times, right, they tend to speak in couplets, where you'll have two clauses that say something that's roughly the same. Yes, Malbim will tell you they're not identical, there's something else coming out of each half. Nonetheless, it's a poetic style, so Ibn Ezra gives you a tip. You hit a sentence like that, and you throw up your hands and say, I don't know what it's talking about. See what you can do with the first half to explain the second half, or, for that matter, vice versa. So that's Ibn Ezra's tip for the day for reading Navi. In number 11, I didn't translate it because I had to sacrifice a source. So I sacrificed that one, or it wouldn't have fit everything on the page. But he's talking about he's just explaining the sentence which we already have, the Neid Katsir Yom Nachalo Ke'evanush. It's fundamentally talking about how the harvest will be lost on the day of this great blow. Okay. So, we've now seen Yeshaya's point to Aram. To the northern kingdom. You have become Canaan again. You reverted. And therefore, all that I gave you is going to be destroyed. And he concludes the chapter with the punishment of the Assyrians who attacked us. So take a look at Pasuk Yud Bet, sentence 12. We are back in Yeshaya again. So what page was that? Anybody have it?
983,
thank you. And here we get again Yeshaya playing with sound. So I'll read the Hebrew first. Hoy hamon amim rabim kahamot yamim yehemayun usha'onli umim ki sha'on mayim kabirim yisha'un. And then more in the next sentence. Le'umim ki sha'on mayim rabim yisha'un. He likes those sounds. He likes those words. What he's saying is, Hamon Amim Rabim, the great number of nations, the masses of nations, but also the noise of nations. Remember, the word Hamon does not only mean multitude, but it also means noise. Hamaya is a reference to confusion with Egypt, but they home, Kalaretz Mitzrayim, many cases like that. The Batehom Kol Ha'ir, Hoy Hamon Amim Rabim, the noise of the many nations. Kahamot Yamim Yehemayun, they make noise like the ocean, like the sea. Sha'on Le'umim, the roar of these nations. Kisha'on Mayim Kabirin Misha'un, they roar like mighty water roaring. He's saying all of these forces, which are the forces of Assyria, they roar and they make such noise. Continues in sentence 13. Le'umim kisha'un mayim ravim yisha'un. The nations are going to roar like the water. V'gar bo, and God is going to scold it. V'nas mimerchak, and it will flee from afar. V'rudaf kimbot harim lifnei ruach, it will be chased away like the chaff on the mountains before the wind. Uch galgal lifnei sufa, like a wheel before the great wind, before the storm. Le'es erev v'hinei valaha, at the time of evening there will be fear. V'terem boker einenu, by the morning they are gone. That's what happens to those who attack us. I see I have like 2 minutes left, but I want to get done as much as I can here. First of all, Rashi suggests here in source number 13 that this is not Assyria specific. This is a statement as indicated by the last sentence that's about everybody, those who attack us. Meaning, Midam Alechad Apnikol Doro, Rashi says it is a divine measure across generations. The ones who hit us will in the end be struck themselves. So Assyria here is going to be that one, the one that will fall. Abarbanel notes, in source number 14, we compare the Assyrians to the water, great water. He says, we are compared to the sand, the enemy is compared to the water, and Hashem is the one who reigns in the water to keep it from overwhelming the sand. I had a few ideas here, but I'm going to stick to just a main point here. The fear of the enemy you can see, but I want to catch one image. If you take a look at the last sentence, Le'es erev v'hinei valaha. At the time of evening there will be fear, and by the morning they are gone. So this is actually a beautiful image, this Le'es Erev. Le'es Erev shows up only 4 times in Tanakh. I know that because my Bar Ilan CD Ram told me that. I was looking at it as Le'es Erev because it comes up in loaded places. I wanted to know, so how many places does it show up? I gave you the 3 other references in source number 16. All of those are times of darkness, but also times of hope and landmark change. The first reference, Breishit 8:11. Anybody know? That's on the boat. When Noah wants to know, is the flood over? Is it safe to come out? The Yonah comes back with the leaf from the olive branch, Le'et Erev. The second one is when Eliezer davens at the well, and Rivka comes out. Le'et Erev, Le'et Seit HaShavavot. It is the time of evening. These are times when things could have gone in different directions. They could have gone horribly wrong. The world remains flooded and is destroyed. We don't have a Rivka, and therefore the Jewish people cannot continue. And instead, hope arises. And the last one is in Zechariah chapter 14, sentence 7, and that's a Le'et Erev Yehiyah Or, referring to Gog and Magog and the arrival of Mashiach. And you put that here with our Le'et Erev, the time when Sancheirav will be turned back from his assault against Yerushalayim. All 4 uses of Eit Erev are times when it looked like we were in trouble, times that looked like we were going to be devastated. But Hashem came through with a divine rescue. I also had a nice medrash to use for this in number 17. Maybe we'll start with that, God willing, next week. But what we really have to see is chapter 18, because that one's going to knock your socks off. So we're going to have to get to chapter 18, God willing, next week. Thank you very much.